South Connection Podcast Network. Welcome back to another edition of The Year That Was. I'm Aaron, and I am taking you through the pay-per-view years of the WWF, WWE. If this is your first time joining the podcast, I spent 3 years watching every pay-per-view. Not back-to-back-to-back-to-back-to-back. I split up the years. I went, did 1 year, say, 99, then I went to 89, stuff like that. I rated them out of, I believe, 12 categories, and now we're doing the reveal of worst pay-per-view years to best pay-per-view years. This is our third installment. The worst pay-per-view year at number 35 was 1995. The second worst was 2010 with the Nexus garbage. And today we're going to talk about a year that's like a really fun nostalgia year, but just doesn't hold up very well to any sort of scrutiny. Before I get to it, though, just a big thank you to everyone who has supported us so far on this new venture, the North-South Connection Podcast Network. If you haven't already, please like this podcast, subscribe, leave us a review. Tell us what you like, what you don't like. We got all kinds of content coming up. It's been a blast so far to put up during this pandemic. But let us know. We're always looking to get better. So check it out. So this is a year where I think it's a very easy year to throw on any show from the year and just kind of watch and have fun. They're all easy watches. It's not like some of the later years where, I mean, you get 2018 and you're like, oh my god, another imagine. I can't imagine myself in 2015 being like, man, I could never. I would have way too much AJ Styles versus Shinsuke Nakamura. And then 2018 happens, and you're dreading watching a match between these two legends. This year's not like that. This year's a fun watch, but it just doesn't hold up, and there's some pretty big problems throughout the year. So I'm going to say it's bad. It finished low. It's the 33rd out of 35 pay-per-view years, but I don't hate this year. I think it's really interesting and fun, and I have a lot of these shows I've watched a million times. So we're looking at 1993, and I think there's some really interesting things that are happening in the WWF at this point. And it really is a year of transition. And I think that kind of hurts the product overall. A couple of through lines that I noticed as I was kind of watching through it and looking about it and thinking about it. One of the big ones is everybody's pretty horribly miscast in this year. It's like when you're watching Bram Stoker's Dracula and suddenly Keanu Reeves shows up and just ruins the entire movie. He's acting next to Gary Oldman and it's terrible. If you're not cast correctly, if you're in the wrong role, you can really hurt whatever the production is, whether it's a theatrical production, a movie, or wrestling. So, for instance, 93 is very much driven by Lex Luger miscast as the chasing hero. In a company that has Bret Hart, who was cheated out of the title. So it's like all the heat that Bret Hart kind of generated through that, through being cheated out of that championship, was transferred to Luger through a body slam on a boat, as opposed to any sort of wrestling storyline. But I mean, he's not the only one. There's lots of characters that are miscast in this year, in the wrong place, in the wrong time. And it's not just heel face either. You could also be miscast in terms of your position on the card. And I think that kind of bears out as we look at a couple of different guys. And the other big through line, the biggest through line, is how empty the cupboard is for wrestlers in this year. Like I said, it's a big transition year. And there's no major stars on the show. There are some every now and then, but you're getting them at a weird period. You're getting Ric Flair at the Rumble. He's a major star, but he's on his way out. He's barely involved, you know. You get Hogan, but it's not a great Hulk Hogan. You know, it's not the Hulk Hogan of the past. It's the walrus and red tights, you know. So you got people that are miscast. You have a cupboard that's bare, but all the while you have Bret Hart holding this thing together like... He's like, if anybody's seen the Spider-Man Homecoming, when Peter Parker is when he's on that ship with the cars, and he's stopping that heist, and it gets blown apart by that high-tech weapon, and he's holding everything with his webs side to side, his body being pulled apart. That's what I think Bret Hart is in 1993. He really has a great year, and that's gonna we're gonna talk about that as we go further. When we did the a few years ago, we did the Place to Be Nation Greatest WWF Wrestler of All Time, and I still don't think I would I would argue that I don't think Bret Hart should be number one of all time. But as I look back at how much he carried the company in years like 93, 95 that we talked about, and I'm sure he's gonna it's gonna come up when we do 94. He was a really important bridge. So I'm becoming more and more of a fan. I mean, it's stupid. I'm from Canada, but I should like him more. And I liked him at the time. There's just I don't know why. There's something a disconnect for me with him. But let's get on to the categories. One of the categories that we talk about is match quality. And that's really just a summation of all of the star ratings for the whole year. Every match has a star rating, and we take it and we average it out. So the average star rating in 1993 is 31st out of 35. And I have the average star rating at 2.61. So it's not horrible, but it's not good either. Like these are all pretty close. Like to give you some context, there's only 11 years that have a star, an average star rating over three, right? And those are really good in ring years. It's near the bottom, but it's small things. Now this year is hurt by a lot of different problems. Match quality isn't necessarily the one. It has a couple stinkers, but it's not. It's by no means any sort of abomination. Although there are abominations. The problem with the year is it's too mediocre in terms of match quality. I have one match cracking 4 stars, and it's we'll talk about it as we get to it, right? But that's not great in a year with 38 matches. Just it's not enough to kind of carry the year, and it really speaks to how difficult the year was. Not only do you not have the stars, but even the guys that are there, they're not churning out the great classic matches, which is a problem. And then you got a couple of really bad matches. I think the worst, I mean, the worst matches of the year, there's many, but the worst matches, there's a series in Undertaker and Giant Gonzalez that aren't good, but they're short. You have that Survivor Series abomination where it's the clowns, Mabel, Mo, and the Bushwhackers against the Head Shrinkers, Bastion Booger, and Bam Bam Bigelow. That's a, it's, it might be one of the worst matches of all time where that food is just, anyway. And but you also get 31 minutes of the Knights battling the Hart family at Survivor Series. Survivor Series is a rough show. And the problem with that match is that the Harts, who haven't wrestled in years, carry the brunt of the match. I mean, why not just have Stu wrestle? He's there. And by the way, there's no way Stu is a Bruins fan. I can guarantee you that man does not give a shit about the Boston Bruins. And the show's over the years also hurt with the Money Inc. Mega Maniacs match eating up so much time. Like I said, it's not the worst year to sit through. Most of the crap is kept short. It's just a weird blend because you got some of the best workers of all time like Bret and Shawn, and some of the worst like the Giant Gonzalez and the Rock and Roll Express. You know, it's a weird amalgamation of a year, and it doesn't end with good matches. Worst match of the year is the aforementioned Bushwhackers and Men on a Mission versus Bigelow, Bastion Booger, and the Head Shrinkers. I mean, there's just food all over the ring. It's like a disgusting mess. And then on top of it, you got Lou Albano and Alpha outside eating like pigs. It's gross. And the action's no good. They're slipping on food. There's grease in the ring. I don't know what Bam Bam Bigelow, I don't know who he pissed off. He must have pissed someone off. And he goes from this to fighting with Doink. All right? Like, so, I don't know. I think Bam Bam might have been the one that had sex with Stephanie McMahon, because you go from slipping over the food with Bastion Booger and company on your team to feuding with the clown for 6 months. Now, why'd they hate Bam Bam? You know, he's a good wrestler. And look, if you took this match, right, Bushwhackers, Men on a Mission, Bigelow, Booger, Head Shrinkers, if I told you that in 2 years' time, one of these men would be challenging for the world title, would you have continued to watch the product? Top five matches of the year. We're going to see a theme happen right away. You're going to understand it right away. The fifth best match of the year, Bret Hart versus Razor Ramon from the Royal Rumble. That's a good dynamic. Bret Hart, I don't want to say carries Ramon because Scott Hall's a good worker, but it's a fun match. But really interesting is it's Ramon's only shot at the WWF Championship. It's crazy. He gets it like 4 months into his run, and then he never gets another one. From WrestleMania, the fourth best match, Bret Hart versus Yokozuna. I think that's a really well carried out match by Bret and Yoko, which I didn't expect on rewatch. I think it's really fun. I think it tells a good story of Bret taking it to him right from the start with that dropkick. Like, he starts right away trying to chip him down, which I think is really cool. And Yoko really sells well for him, too. It's got a screwy finish, but the match up until that point was really fun. Number three, Bret Hart versus Razor Ramon from King of the Ring. So Razor making the list two times. I think it's a bit better match than the Royal Rumble match, but still not the best of the year. The number two match of the year, Bret Hart versus Bam Bam Bigelow, King of the Ring. The final, it shows that Bigelow is capable of having great matches. He's an over character, and it's the culmination of Bret Hart's great night at the King of the Ring. And the number one match of the year, Bret Hart versus Mr. Perfect at the King of the Ring, which I think is an improvement over their 1991 match, which is strange because I think Perfect is miscast as a face throughout this year. But he pulls out a really cool match here. Maybe it's because he starts to heal it up a little bit in the match with Bret Hart. I just think it's a really solid match. It's fun. It's a worthy match of the year. It's not like some years where you're like, I guess it's this. No, it's a good match. And man, thank heavens for the King of the Ring. I mean, it has three of the top five matches. But thank heavens for Bret Hart, who's got five of the top five matches. I don't think there's another year where that anything like that comes even close. And when you think about it, too, he has less matches. Like, I mean, there are some years where guys will wrestle 13, 14 times on pay-per-view. So it's conceivable that they might have five of those at the top five. Bret Hart wrestles eight times. He's got five of them in the top five. That's incredible. Next category is characters. I had that at 18th out of 35. There's good and bad. The good's good, the bad's bad. You got underdog champion Bret Hart, who works really well. Again, he's not a top, tippy-top guy, but he's an interesting champion in that he's a bit of an underdog. He's always beatable. So even at WrestleMania, they go on and on about how Bret Hart's the underdog in the match, which I think is fascinating. You had never had that before, so it was cool. You got Bam Bam Bigelow, who comes in as a killer. He comes in, he's beating guys up, really good showing at King of the Ring. He's in that six-man at the SummerSlam, and at any other, they don't know what to do with him, but he comes in with so much potential, and he feels like a bit of a big deal. Maybe it's because it's depleted, but he still feels cool. You have a man who believes himself to be the portrait of vanity from Greek mythology. Also interesting, he would be the template for milk-drinking Kurt Angle years later. You have a Samoan man masquerading as a Japanese sumo wrestler. A legitimate badass amateur wrestler as a team, Rick and Scott. One of them happens to bark like a dog, and that's fine. You have a Finnish environmentalist and an evil clown. Now, those are the good characters. Here's the ones that are not so good. And you can really tell what their defining characteristic is. Because look, even Bret's brave, he's a fighter, he's a family man. You know a lot about him. There's substance to his character, right? Maybe he's the only fully one. I would say even the Finnish environmentalist, like, he's got something he's working for. It's not like he just hates the USA. He hates the USA because they've destroyed the environment, his Finnish environment. And I would say even the evil clown has some depth in terms of, like, what is, like, there's mystery involved in an evil clown. Why is he this way? Why did he become a clown? Why is he evil? Contrast that with a man who enjoys crushing things. It's like they named him from Demolition and then said, you know what, we're going to stick with that forever. He's going to be crushed. Doesn't matter what he does. Oh, but the next one, he could be a crush. Then he turns bad, and he's I don't know what he is when he turns bad. He's from Hawaii. It's almost like he's a pseudo-Japanese guy, because he's doing martial arts and shit with Mr. Fuji. But he's still crushed. And then he goes to jail, and he comes back crushed. And I can't imagine people calling him a crush in jail. I think it might be because they couldn't call him Bryan Adams because of the singer. Like, you don't want a man that size being known for... everything I do it for you, or cuts like a knife. It's maybe not the best look for Crush. But at this point, when he's all decked out in fluorescent yellow and purple and orange and with the mullet, like, his whole character is that he likes to crush things. That's his whole job. That's his whole character. It might be one of the worst characters of all time. Next, we have a living, breathing atomic bomb wearing the same colors as Crush. At least he looked impressive. Plucky underdog face, Bob Backlund. In 1993, you have a hairy mountain giant, a guy who loves the USA, and a regular ass clown. It's funny how the turns made the characters worse. So normally you turn with a certain motivation that kind of pushes you forward, right? Like in 97, Bret Hart turns because he hates the United States. Well, he doesn't hate the United States, but he hates U.S. fans and how they've changed. And it makes him a more full and complete character. Vince McMahon goes from the super nice announcer to a guy who's suddenly very upset about his company being taken over by a redneck. So it's like the best turns take something and build upon it. Whereas you have an evil, interesting clown who suddenly just becomes a fun-loving clown who's doing fun tricks at ringside. And imagine, one of the Lex Luger is basically named after a Greek god who looks at himself in a pool and falls in love with himself. That's the extent of the depth of his character there, right? But when they make him the USA guy, it's less deep. They go from it's like it can't get any more shallow than the guy looking at himself in the pool of water. But it's just, I love the USA and I'm on a bus all of a sudden. So it's no surprise that this year doesn't rank super well with characters. Next category is WrestleMania. This was what JT and I did when we ranked all the WrestleMania cards. We had it 33rd out of 35th. And this is it's weird because it's a cool Mania. It's not that it's not watchable. The setting's cool. It flows pretty well. The finishes are the problem of the matches because they're just really poorly planned out. So if you just go through it quickly. Intercontinental title match, count out finish. Tag match ends with a murder. Third match, multiple doink finish. Razor rolling up Bob Backlund. Jimmy Hart impersonating a referee. Perfect getting pinned with his feet on the ropes. Giant Gonzalez using a chloroform to get disqualified. Bret Hart gets salt in the eyes. And then Yokozuna gets hit in the head with a bucket. So that's 2 of 9 matches actually have a clean finish. Everything else is a fuck finish. And on WrestleMania, it's just not acceptable. Like it really hurts the car. There's nothing ends here, although it all ends. So for instance, Tatanka doesn't get another shot at the title, even though he wins by countout. Crush never goes back to feuding with Doink. Razor, well, Backlund doesn't come back for his revenge against Razor. Hogan and Money Inc., all that's just finished after this. Mr. Perfect and Lex Luger, it's finished. Gonzalez, this one continues. Of course, Gonzalez and Undertaker is the one to continue. Of all the feuds, Gonzalez and Undertaker is the one that has to continue. Yoko and Bret doesn't continue, and Hogan and Yoko does. So it's a weird WrestleMania. It doesn't finish anything. It ends with a happy ending with Hogan on top, but it's not happy to most people. It was happy to me as a 13-year-old watching it, but yeah, it's all the fuck finishes. And I imagine poor Jim Ross coming in from WCW. And this is his first show, right? And like, I know they did bullshit with RoboCop and such, but this is the guy who called some of the most athletic matches in history. He called Flair Steamboat. He called the Flair Garvins, the Dusty Rhodes stuff, all the Midnight Express matches. The list goes on and on about real legitimate matches that this guy called. And that's what he was really great at. He's really great at selling the emotion of this fake sport, right? Now they stuff him in a toga, and they want him to sell multiple doinks, jumping in and out of the ring, a guy in a naked bodysuit snuffing out an undead zombie with a chloroform face cloth. The poor guy must have been so lost. There must have been a thought of, what did I get myself into? Now, he goes on to talk about how it's one of the greatest things of his life, and I'm really happy for him. But what a culture shock it must have been to go from the NWA and WCW to this, and especially with this show. Because if you go back, I mean, if you just go ahead to SummerSlam, it's less ridiculous than WrestleMania is. And of course, this Mania is also really hurt by that tag match, Hogan and Beefcake against Money Inc. Money Inc. being one of the worst tag teams of all time, in my view. And the Mega Maniacs being, I don't know, one of the most obnoxious. It never worked with Jimmy Hart and Hulk Hogan. It just never, ever worked. Next category, world title storyline. I have it 31st out of 35th. And I think things were actually really fine until WrestleMania. And it really started to go downhill once they decided to make the focus Hogan and Yokozuna. And then they turned Luger, which I think was their worst possible mistake. Because I think Luger, I'm not a Lex Luger hater by any means. I like Lex Luger. I think he's completely underused in WWF, and I really love a lot of his NWA work. Even his later WCW work. Like, he's so good in 1995 as kind of the tweener guy. But if we go back to him chasing as a face champion, all right, every time he chased as a face champion, he was in there with some of the greatest heels of all time, right? So, for instance, like the first time in 88 when he's chasing Flair for the NWA title, number one, Flair and Luger had this built-up relationship for them being part of the Four Horsemen, right? So it was easy to garner sympathy for Luger because Luger's not an easy guy to garner sympathy for. He's not super likable. He's a good-looking, muscular guy. So a lot of time, and he doesn't quite have the charisma of, like, say, Hogan or Ultimate Warrior, right? But because Flair and the Horsemen were so great at drawing heat, anybody could shine as a result with the right storyline. And the storyline was there. And Luger did great with it, right? I'm not shitting on Luger. But I think the pieces were there for him to succeed. And the only other time that Luger has been a top-level chasing babyface was when he was chasing Hogan in the NWO, culminating in that the title win on Nitro in 1997. But, I mean, you're chasing Hulk Hogan at that point, who is, again, he doesn't get enough credit for being one of the greatest heels of all time. So he's not the greatest chaser, right? Unless he has a great heel. And unfortunately, Yokozuna is not that kind of heel. And Luger at this point is just not that kind of face. He doesn't have the connection. Because he comes into the company build so full of himself that Bobby Heenan almost forgets about Ric Flair for 5 minutes, right? He's a dastardly dick. He's hitting people with the forearm. But suddenly, just because he loves America, I don't know why he loves America. It's never explained. But, like, I mean, if you want to get deep into it, narcissist doesn't love anybody except himself. He didn't love Greece more than I imagine, like, him looking at the pool and then Zeus coming down and being like, "Hey, the Spartans are really coming on to Athens here, man. We need someone to go fight the Spartans." And then out of the clouds comes Narcissus, even though he's been looking at himself in the pool of water for the past 6 years or whatever. The turn makes no sense, right? What I don't get is why they just didn't, instead of doing Zero, why didn't they just have Yokozuna beat up his family to garner sympathy? Like the family we saw at the Survivor Series when he welcomes everybody, from your family to mine, Lex Luger, you know? Could have beaten up his kid and he could have banged/squashed Luger's wife, you know? It could have been like, it would have been way better than the Greyhound Tour across America. There's just no reason to start cheering for him, other than he did a hip toss to Yokozuna on the deck of a ship. And it was just an incredibly unorganic heel turn when anything else would have helped. And again, like I said, it's not Luger's fault. Luger's great. He succeeded everywhere but WWF. And I think it's really unfair that guys like Luger, guys like Ronnie Garvin, you know, these are guys that are often solely judged on their WWF work when they just don't fit into that system. There's guys that just don't fit into the system, right? There are very few, like, I could even venture Ric Flair didn't necessarily fit into the system till much later. He was always different. He was always an outsider. Flair was just so good that he fit in anywhere, right? There's just some guys that work better in the NWA, WCW, and some guys work better in WWF. And Luger's one of them. And unfortunately, they built the year around him. And this year is also the beginning of the search for the next Hulk Hogan. But it's also a big failure to learn from history. Because they never get the next guy they're looking for. They never got the next Bruno. They got the first Bob Backlund. They got the first Pedro Morales. They went back to Bruno. But they never got the next Bruno. They never got the next Backlund. They got the first Hulk Hogan. And every time they try to copy the star who came before, that person is always set up for failure. And so this is the first year we see it, and we see it, we talked about it in 1995. We see it with Lex Luger, we see it with Diesel, when they're just really kind of sacrificed at the altar of Hogan. And it's a mistake they've continuously made. John Cena suffered this forever too, because I think they tried to make him too much like The Rock. They were looking for the next Rock. And I think Reigns, they're trying to look for the next Cena. So you're always, instead of letting these guys be themselves and create their characters organically, you're trying to shoehorn them into rules that they don't necessarily fit, right? And every time the business has boomed, every time it's boomed, it's been with something new. It's been with Hogan being crazy over, in contrast to Backlund, who's an amateur wrestler. It's into Stone Cold Steve Austin, who's more of a talker and a rebel than the baby faces, right? New stuff is always what pushed them forward. For the world title storyline, I mean, I don't want to play too much of a fantasy booker here, but I feel like this is such a year where the dream scenario was right there. Right? It was right there. So I think the key would be to leave Bret Hart champion until SummerSlam. right? And you can do what you want at Mania. You could either have him defend against Yokozuna at Mania and then Randy Savage at King of the Ring, or vice versa. Either one will work. Savage will probably make a better match at WrestleMania. But the key is to build him up, because if you want to build him up as a top guy, you got to have him beat top guys, right? You keep Luger heel, he wins the King of the Ring, and he defeats Bret at SummerSlam. And then Bret chases for the rest of the year. I know it kind of fucks over Yokozuna, and I don't hate Yokozuna. I just think it just wasn't the place and time for him in terms of what would have been great for business. Business, not necessarily, maybe even just storyline, maybe just my own personal preference. Remember, this is all my personal preference, right? So please, if you disagree with me, by all means, let me know. I don't think my views are infallible or anything like that. Now, in contrast to the world title storyline, the mid-card storyline, there's actually there's some cool stuff happening in the mid-card. Because it's anchored to Shawn Michaels for a lot of the year. He's really kind of coming into his own. He's not having the classic matches yet. He's not Shawn Michaels yet. But he's a really good Intercontinental Champion. And his feuds with Jannetty and Perfect, they might not have delivered the very best quality matches you've ever seen. But they were good. And in Jannetty in particular, it felt like a real blood feud, which was cool. It had some great stuff with Sherry getting smashed in the face. And you also got the rise of the 1-2-3 Kid. I don't know if they did this on purpose, but they stumble into one of the best babyface characters of the 90s, being Razor Ramon. I mean, Razor was so cool. You know, he was the coolest guy. I mean, at the time, I was 13, right? So I remember at the bus stop one morning telling my buddy I wanted to grow up my facial hair to look like Razor's. And he asked me, he said, do girls like that? And I couldn't imagine a world in which women wouldn't like that. Maybe I was really attracted to Razor Ramon. Holy shit. Mate, well, look, by the time we get to Survivor Series, Razor is as over as anyone, and it's actually quite shocking he never got a title run or even another title opportunity, championship opportunity. We're still in the era, too, where everything's given a story, so while I kind of, like, shit on Doink and Crush a little bit, which I really like the Doink and Crush stuff, I think it's ridiculous on a card with everything else, it's a fuck finish, but... whatever, it was different. But at least it's built on somewhat solid foundations. It's not guys just thrown together because they're having matches. It's also a pretty big falling off for Tatanka, who at WrestleMania was probably the fourth face in the pecking order of the company. I'd have Undertaker, Bret Hart, and Mr. Perfect ahead of him. You can say Savage too, but he wasn't really wrestling. But fourth, but then they don't do anything with him for the rest of the year. So the mid-card here is carried by Bret Hart, which is awkward because he starts the year as champion, right? And it's carried by Bret Hart, and he's got a great feud with Jerry Lawler. It starts the King Ring with Jerry Lawler busting that shit on his head. But it's a personal feud. It's wonderful. And it starts the King Ring, lasts for 2 years. And it's kind of a shame that Lawler wasn't at Survivor Series, because that match dies a slow death without him, because he would have really helped the heat in that match. And Lawler's heel work is great from at SummerSlam, with his fist in the air being carted off and the whole speech about why he couldn't wrestle. He really has a solid year, too. And what struck me as I was looking at this mid-card is, like, wow, if this mid-card had tippy-top level guys in the main event supporting it, this year would be a lot better. Tag team storyline. I'm always just flabbergasted with 93 how everything happens off TV. You got the Steiners, that are one of the greatest tag teams of all time. They have fantastic matches. I love the Beverly Brothers match, the Head Shrinkers match, the Heavenly Bodies. But all their title wins are off TV. And so as a consequence, you don't get a lot of story development on the pay-per-views, right? And their eventual replacement, the Quebecers, are amazing, because being from Quebec, they're pure French Canadians. And the way they yell and scream at each other in French and shove each other is incredible, because it's exactly what the people of Quebec are like. They're funny. I mean, they're an exaggeration, obviously. But like, oh, ben, le tabarnak, you know, I've seen these people get upset like this, and it's beautiful. So the tag title scene is really interesting in that it produces a lot of cool matches, especially with the Steiners on top. Man, I wish we could have had another 3-4 years with the Steiners, but then again, maybe not. Then they'd be fighting the Smoking Guns and the Cat, you know. Anyway, it's funny. The more I find I get into the NWA and WCW, because I used to be such a WWF homer, exactly what I just kind of articulated. Man, I wish the Steiners would have stuck around. But on the flip side, like, I would much rather see them in WCW wrestling WCW-style tag matches, as someone who's really coming into a discovery of WCW now. Women's storyline category, there's nothing really going on here. There's no women's matches. There's nothing but Luna Vachon brutalizing Sherry and Sherry getting smashed in the face with a mirror. It's just it's a rough year for Sherry. Royal Rumble match. So again, this one's not really shitting on the fans the way, say, 2014, 2015 do. We have it 20. I have it 29th out of 33 Rumbles. And it's the first time that the title shot's on the line at WrestleMania, but they go with Yokozuna. As it's funny because he's the only odds-on favorite big guy to ever win this whole thing. And the big problem with this Rumble is that the hottest guys in the company aren't in long enough. So Flair goes in at number one, which is great. He lasts 18 minutes, which is good, but he's thrown out by Perfect. Perfect's only in there 9 minutes. Undertaker's in there for less than 5 minutes. And it's like, at least if those guys had been there at the end, Yoko could have earned the win over some top guys. Instead, he throws a clueless Randy Savage, who, despite being in three previous Royal Rumbles, tries to pin the Japanese Samoan, you know? You got a departing Flair, Mr. Perfect, an underused Savage, and 1993 Undertaker as your top guys in the Rumble. It's a big problem. It speaks again to how bare the cupboard is, right? But there are high spots in the Rumble. Bob Backlund's awesome. He's so fun to watch because he starts off with no one giving a shit about him. And by the time he throws out, oh, I can't even remember who it is, but whoever he throws out to get down to the final four, the crowd goes crazy for him. I think he breaks the longevity record and he gets himself over in the match. And then there's no follow-up. He spends an hour getting himself over in this match. And then they feed him to Ramon at the next pay-per-view, which is fine because you're building up Razor Ramon, right? But I think that might be Backlund's first pinfall loss in the WWF, losing to Razor Ramon. Maybe his only pinfall loss ever. Oh, no, he loses to Diesel. So up until that point, it was his first loss, right? But, like, why not do something with him after that? I don't understand. But, I mean, the big problem with this, too, is that the whole Rumble. It's we talked about the top stars, but listen to this list of guys, right? Papa Shango, Brian Knobbs, Virgil, not Ember Moon. Max Moon. Tenru, Skinner, Coco Beware, Berserker, Terry Taylor, Damon Demento, Sags, Typhoon, Earthquake, Youngster Carlos Colon, Tito Santana, and Repo Man. That's 16 guys out of the 30 who are not on pay-per-views again that year. Not that every single person needs to be on every pay-per-view. I'd actually think we should split it up a bit more. But the problem is the Rumble is populated with a bunch of guys that didn't matter. Nobody in that list mattered. You couldn't look at one of those guys and think they're going to win the Royal Rumble. And even then, when you get past these guys, there's guys like the Headshrinkers are not going to win the Royal Rumble. At least they wrestle on pay-per-view for the rest of the year. Right? 16 out of 30 are guys that are meaningless for the rest of the year. And they're badly booked because they're carrying a large percentage of the match. As much as I hate to say it, I throw Backlund into that too because they don't do anything with him after, right? Also, Terry Taylor should probably not wear red to the ring if he doesn't want to be called the rooster by the audience. Historical importance is another category. JT and I did a podcast on this on No Holds Barred. It's in the archives. Check it out. We have it 34th out of 35 years. Because is there any historical anything to this? Perhaps the birth of King of the Ring as a pay-per-view and the debut of Jim Ross. But everything else, nothing really matters. There's the stunning debut of Luna Vachon. And I mean, when you look back at it, the only refute is Brett and Lawler. We also saw The Undertaker love the USA, all right, as he revealed that his jacket was lined with an out-of-date U.S. flag. I'm struggling. There's just nothing going on here. SummerSlam, we have it 28th out of 33. Again, it's not horrible to watch. It's just underwhelming. You get an underwhelming Michaels Perfect match, and it just helps sink a really lackluster card. And Luger and Yoko, their match in the end was okay. I thought it was fine. Luger jumping around like he'd won the championship was kind of dumb. But the match was fine. It's just there's no star power on the show. The best parts are Brett fighting twice. So he beats the shit out of Doink and then has a fun match with Lawler. And then loses the King of the Ring title, which I think is really funny. And you got the Steiners ripping it up with the Smoky Mountain tag team of the Dr. Desire and the Gigolo, Jimmy Dale Ray. That's really those two things, Brett wrestling twice and the Steiners, are really good. With some support, they would add and make a really nice SummerSlam. I would also say that another high point is future Finnish politician Ludwig Borga destroying Martti Jannetty. He'd go on to be a member of the Finnish Parliament for the True Finn Party, which is founded on Finnish nationalism. It's, you know, to be honest, it's kind of a shame he's no longer in politics, as everything seems to be leaning towards right-wing populism. I could just imagine the summit of him and Trump, where Trump's trying to force that handshake on him. Ludwig Borga can put him up, throw him up in the air, and punch him in the gut. That'd be good. The worst show of the year this year was the Survivor Series, which is a shame because I genuinely like the Survivor Series matches, especially when the Survivor Series card, especially when there's Survivor Series matches. But it just never, you get the Razor Ramon Jannetty team, which is, it's a fun match, but everything else kind of falls below the wayside. And then you got you got the Hearts match, which is just way too long. And then four clowns. Oh, fuck you. You get two rappers in whiteface and a heel team masquerading as functional human beings who know how to eat. It's really brutal. I hate that match so much. The best show of the year is King of the Ring this year. It's a fun tournament. It's carried entirely Bret Hart. It's one of the few King of the Rings that they get right, which is cool. Yeah, it's a really good show top to bottom. You take out the Hogan stuff, you got an excellent show. We're going to do our top five wrestlers, bottom five wrestlers, top five wrestlers. Then we're out of here. Five worst wrestlers of the year. Number five, the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase. I think he doesn't finish lower because the tag match is awful at WrestleMania 9, but he's got a pretty good match with Ramon to cap off his career. And I always thought it was funny that I always hated Ted DiBiase on whenever he was bashing the Ultimate Warrior. Because there's such an arrogance to him talking about how a Warrior couldn't work. But this coming from a guy who has an incredibly dismal pay-per-view record. Ted DiBiase just never clicked for me. It's funny. It's the opposite of what we were talking about earlier with Luger. Luger and Garvin get credit for their work. Don't get credit for their work everywhere else. They think it. Everybody thinks it sucks, and I think they judge them on their WWF work. Ted DiBiase has shitty WWF work, although great character work, great work elsewhere. But everybody just gives him a pass because he was great before. It's a weird thing. Number four, worst wrestler of the year, Irwin R. Scheister. I think it's just because he's in that tag match and he doesn't have a redeeming match with Ramon, and he manages to make the 1-2-3 kid uninteresting at SummerSlam, which is almost impossible. Number three, worst wrestler of the year, The Undertaker. This poor guy is in there with Giant Gonzalez for a whole year. Imagine being married to Giant Gonzalez for a whole year. God, him coming down on you with the force of 1,000 violins. You're going to see as we go through the 90s, he constantly ends up in the worst of the year. But, I mean, he should probably get some sort of an award rather than me ridiculing his Betsy Ross flag. The second worst rest of the year, Hulk Hogan. Let's see. Is one of the worst tag team matches of all time. He ruins a good WrestleMania main event. He gets a camera exploded into his face rather than doing a clean job. And he's a shell of his former self. I think Bret Hart in his book called him an old walrus, and I think that's very apropos. And the worst wrestler of the year? It can't be anyone other than Giant Gonzalez. He might be one of the worst wrestlers of all time. He's wearing the stupidest gear of all time. Get this guy out of here. I guess he did leave life, so I'm a bad person. Five best wrestlers of the year. Number five, Lex Luger. I think if not for the Survivor Series stinker, this would probably be Bam Bam Bigelow's slot. I think Luger kind of slept in here, but this is kind of an example of how kind of weak the year was in totality, because Luger didn't have any great matches. He had a couple of good matches, but nothing really pushed him forward. Number four, Martti Jannetty. I love it that he made this list, and Shawn Michaels doesn't. Right, I think he's just Mr. Consistency. You know, he's solid with Shawn. He puts over Borga. He's good in the Survivor Series match. Years ago, I did a pod blast with JT about should we include Martti Jannetty in the top 100 wrestlers of all time. I think I still say no, but I'm really happy to see him shine here. I think it's cool. Number three, best wrestler of the year, Mr. Perfect. I think he's really helped by that match of the year with Bret. The rest of his year is a bit lackluster, but I don't know. He's not horrible. Number two, Razor Ramon, as he's transitioning into a guy near the top of the card. It's weird that he fits so nicely into that face role, and he's just so good as a face. And the number one wrestler of the year, should come as no surprise, is Bret Hart. It's funny, even watching these pay-per-views that I didn't appreciate him, putting the project together and talking about him, He's kind of undeniable as like an incredible force in the early 90s. In this year, he's in the top five matches of the year. He wrestles 8 times on pay-per-view, and 7 of them are in the top 12. And the only thing that's out of it is a Survivor Series match. It's such an outlier because it's carried by his brothers, who are, one's a fireman, one's a teacher. But and even that match, as much as I don't like the match, it starts off a really great storyline. It's kind of a shame. Yeah. So 93, it starts off kind of a, as a whole, kind of a dark age for the WWF. And I think it's because for the first time in forever, they're really without a tippy-top star. I mean, they always leaned on Bruno and Backlund and Hogan, Warrior, Savage. I mean, Savage is there, but he's not himself. And here they have Bret Hart and Undertaker on top, but I think it could be argued that neither of them become a really tippy-top guy until about 1997. With the tail end of the Austin stuff and the Canada stuff, and Undertaker really ascending and winning the title of WrestleMania. Up until that point, I think he's just like, he's the attraction, right? And 93 is weird too, because they're trying things, but their stubborn refusal to let go of the All-American hero chasing the fat heel really unravels what could have been a really interesting year. I mean, even if they'd done Bret and Lawler for the championship, it might have been more interesting than Luger and Yoko. Or do Luger and Yoko in the undercard, you know? Or just keep Luger heel. Keep Luger heel. Don't have Yoko in the main events. Wrestling was changing, and the company's refusal to acknowledge it and roll with it is a lesson they won't learn until, I think, the next year. I think 94 is where it kind of sinks in. They need to focus on their strengths, their strengths being in-ring excellence. And as soon as they figured that out, the product got a whole lot better. And, you know, over the course of this project, at least so far, with 2010 and 2095, I've always said that, like, if one, just one of the shows would have been better, they wouldn't have finished where it was. But this is a really interesting year in that you have a pretty bad Royal Rumble match, you've got a bad WrestleMania, you've got a mediocre SummerSlam. And those three things end up really hurting the year. And I think it's obvious, to me anyway, why it finished as low as it did. I didn't hate watching it. I loved watching it, actually, in a lot of ways. It brought me back. It's a really fun nostalgia year. But quality, importance, storylines, characters, it just kind of falls apart. So, check out all the great content we have on the North South Wrestling Connection podcast network. We got lots of fun shows. We got Extreme Three-Way Dance, which is tearing it up through ECW. Chad Campbell's Lighting the World on Fire with the Fighting Spirit of 06, which I think is a really interesting year, too. He's also got Carolina Dreaming, which is going through a lot of obscure old NWA, WCW matches. As some of you guys know, PlaceToBeNation.com, this year's stretch project is the greatest WCW match of all time. And Chad's breaking down a few that you probably wouldn't normally look at. And I'll be honest, in his first episode, he uncovered a gem with Roddy Piper and Jack Briscoe. And top to bottom, man, I watched that thing and I loved every second of it. So check out that podcast, Carolina Dreaming. What I do now with it is I look at the matches he's covering, I go watch those matches, and then go back for the commentary because I don't want to have the matches spoiled for me. But check it out. Still going on at North South Connection, we have Jacob Williams' Ruthlessly Aggressive podcast. A fun listening. He's got a rotating guest. They're going through the Ruthless Aggression era. Nobody's done that before. Jeff Learns Wrestling is going to come back. JT and I, we got No Holds Barred. JT and Chad's Wrestling Warzone. Reg and I going Montreal to Memphis. If you've listened to this and haven't listened to that, I think it's a really fun show. Our last episode was about Sid Justice and how much we love him, so check it out. Also, to bring back up Place to Be Nation again, throughout 2019, we were voting for the greatest WWF match of all time, and a lot of that watching helped me kind of formulate my list for this show. So check out PlaceToBeNation.com. They're doing the reveal very soon of the top 100 matches of all time. So much work went into that, Tyler Kelly especially. So check it out. They've worked extremely hard, and it's a super fun project. And listen, if you're running a business and you want help with search engine optimization, check out Chris Walker on Legit.com. He helped us out with some of our publicity going through on social media, but his company's really cool at helping drive awareness to your business and helping it grow. So check it out, Legit.com. Please help him out. Continue please supporting the North South Connection podcast network. Thank you so much for listening to The Year That Was. If you want to talk to me, I'm at Aaron D. George on Twitter. Hit me up on comments, feedback, yell at me on Facebook. Look up my number in the phone book and check it out. This was The Year That Was, 1993. Now, join us next week when, or next week, next time in 2 weeks, when we look at a year where that might have had some of the most interesting possible storylines going on television, but the pay-per-view year suffered as a result. Looking forward to talking to it. Thanks, guys. See you again.